He sent a mail saying that, boss, your system is not working. I was trying to buy and the money is not going through. I can't complete the transaction. Then I was like on guard duty at night to make sure that nothing goes wrong. I had my tech person on duty. But it was like a matter of life and death.
Welcome to Backstage with Millionaires, the show where we bring you the stories of real Indian startups told by the entrepreneurs that built them. I'm Caleb Friesen, and on the show today, how Avnish Anand joined a fledgling startup as employee number one and built it up into CaratLane, India's first and only jewelry unicorn. There was a time in India when ordering jewelry online was unthinkable. Trust in e-commerce was low, with many people worrying about scams and hackers stealing their credit card information. But more than that, people just didn't want to buy an expensive ring, necklace, or earrings without first trying them on. CaratLane was one of the first companies in India that saw this as an opportunity. They realized that the internet represented a way into the crowded, competitive jewelry space where offline retail giants reigned supreme and also hadn't yet begun trying to sell their massive inventories through websites. And CaratLane's first founder, Mithun Sacheti, understood just how traditional India's jewelry industry was. His parents had founded a niche jewelry store in 1974 called Jaipur Gems in Mumbai, and over the years, he had helped his parents expand into South India and gained a lot of industry insight and experience along the way. In 2007, Mithun decided to launch his own jewelry business out of Chennai, with the goal of selling loose diamonds and diamond jewelry online. His timing couldn't have been better either, because this was the same year that Flipkart started in Bengaluru and India's e-commerce industry as a whole was beginning to take shape. Mithun teamed up with Srinivasa Gopalan to co-found the company and then hired their first employee, who happens to be our guest today, Avnish Anand. When Avnish first met Mithun and Srinivasa in August of 2007, he was in the midst of a career transition. He'd done brief stints at Onida, Standard Chartered Bank, and DuPont India, but none of these positions left him feeling fulfilled. And it wasn't until his wife joined a startup, BharatMatrimony.com, that he realized what he'd been missing out on: entrepreneurship. He could see how hard she was working, the long hours that she was putting in, and the passion with which she was building this company. And he wanted to be a part of something similar. So when he got an opportunity to apply for a job as the first employee of a brand new internet retail business, he agreed to go to an interview even though he didn't know anything about it.
So the first interview, they didn't tell me anything. The second interview also, they didn't tell me anything.
At that point, did you even know that it was like a jeweler?
I didn't know what they were planning to do also. They just said it's something to do with retail and internet. So that those words were interesting for me. After the first two conversations, then they told me what the plan was. And obviously, they were inspired by Blue Nile. Mithun had this family background in the jewelry business. Gopal obviously was a technology person who had been in SIFI, if I remember correctly, which was at one stage a fairly important company in the Indian context.
And then it started his own startup as well.
Yeah, so then he started Lister. So, and then I took some time to think about it, spoke to some people. You know, I could not come up with, other than the regular reasons, right, that it's a risky role and the company could close. I didn't think of any other downside.
Was there any part of you,
upsides in that?
Was there any part of you that was like, I don't know anything about jewelry, so this isn't for me?
No, I was not. See, because everything which I'd done prior to that also, if I worked in a bank, did I know about banking? No. I worked in a consumer electronics company, did I know anything about it? No. So that was not a problem. And I just thought ki, I can figure out the internet part. I would want to learn about it. I can try and figure out the retail part. I would want to learn about it.
So you officially joined, I believe it was August 2007. Yeah.
Yes.
And it wouldn't be another year before the business actually started.
Yes.
So what did you guys do?
It was very hard because all the pieces which we needed, right? It was very difficult back then. So starting with the website, you know, if we had Shopify or Magento back then, it would have been a piece of cake. But we were building this thing on this platform called OS Commerce. So that took a lot of time. And we were trying to integrate the diamond supply chain with it. You know, the feed of the diamonds, the solitaires from all this. So that took some time. you know, when we were looking for a payment gateway, that took so much time because there was no options and none of the banks were ready. So just going and convincing them would take a lot of time. We did some research also to understand the market because nobody really was a so much of a consumer person in that sense who had a very good feel. So while Mithun's family business is into jewelry, but they are a, you know, they had two stores at that time, one in Chennai and one in Bombay, and they operate in the very premium space. So it was, while that information was useful, but we couldn't just go with that.
And that wasn't the business model either, right?
You were planning to offer completely different business
more model. Affordable jewelry.
Yes. So we had to do some research, obviously hiring the other set of people, training them, coming with a training program. You know, simple things that writing the terms and conditions. We couldn't find a lawyer who could do that. We finally found a girl, a lady in Bangalore who wrote it for us. Then getting the logistics. Nobody, no courier company in this country was willing to ship jewelry because there was so much risk. So it took multiple meetings with Blue Dart before they finally agreed to do that. You can't have a business if you don't have a courier company, right? Who will go ship the products?
Yeah. This is really, I mean, this is super early for you guys. This is like...
I'm telling you, this is, you know, there was no Flipkart back then. That's what I tell people to give them context.
Yeah.
I think the most advanced businesses in terms of the internet were obviously the media businesses, the classified businesses, and there were these early marketplaces, Rediff and India Times. You know, we used to sell on those websites and it was so funny. They would tell us that, why don't you make a ring for 800 rupees? Then it'll sell really well. And I would tell them that, boss, I need at least 1 gram of metal to make a product, right? How can I make anything for 800 rupees? But yeah, though there were very limited options to market a internet business also back then, other than Google Ads. Facebook also, if you remember, there was hardly any Facebook. The basic Facebook model was the time when Orkut was still more popular than Facebook. And obviously there was MySpace for a little bit. So it was not the age where you could run Facebook ads and all. So it took a, and because we didn't know better, we made a lot of mistakes also. Things which we had to redo. So finally, after having put everything together, and especially the website took the longest time because we had kind of got Blue Dart, the gateway, the inventory. And then after the survey, which we did, a consumer survey, we realized that there was no way we could just build a business with Solitaire because India was not ready for it and we had to get jewelry. So we had to quickly figure out, at least a small catalog of jewelry. And we were lucky that thanks to Mithun's family business, we were able to get at least some designs to start with and get some more designs made lightweight. Obviously, their family business is more premium, but we managed to get some basic designs in place to at least get started.
Yeah, this is what I've gathered. And I want you to tell this story, the story of your first customer. But it seems like that piece of jewelry was a little bit pricier than...
Yeah, it was a solitaire.
Yeah.
So the solitaires could, a solitaire, it's like all these suppliers of solitaires, they have this feed, right? Their information, digital information about the stones which they have, which is available.
Can you just break that down for me? Sorry, solitaire. Like, what is that?
A solitaire is a large diamond.
Large diamond. Okay.
So if you were a supplier, I got your inventory to be listed on my website. So we had a very large listing, more than 1 lakh stones from vendors across the world, all the major diamond centers. So in that sense, technically there was a stone which somebody could have bought for 10 crores also. It was listed.
Wow.
We didn't own it, but the optionality or the option to buy such a stone was there. And again, I think sometimes you get lucky, right? So this gentleman was a fairly successful person, an Indian who was working in Japan for a large multinational company, so obviously very successful. And I think it was a landmark anniversary. When I say landmark, meaning one of those important milestone ones. And I think being in Japan, he was definitely far more comfortable with digital buying and making a large payment online. He obviously was well-to-do, so the money was not such a big thing for him. And I think he also was far more aware of solitaires because he never asked me a question that what is a good color or what is a good clarity or what should I buy or not buy. And it was a GIA certified stone. So GIA is like the best certification which you can get, the most widely accepted in the world. So
he was communicating with you. Was it like, did he call you guys up?
He sent a mail saying that, boss, your system is not working. I was trying to buy and the money is not going through. I can't complete the transaction.
How soon after you guys launched did this happen?
I think this would have happened in the first less than 10 days.
10 days. Okay.
Then we had to go and convince the bank to allow us to take this transaction. So there were two kinds of risk. One that, obviously, jewelry, again, nobody wanted to touch. So after a lot of convincing, they had given us a certain upper cap of 50,000 for a transaction. And this is close to 7 lakhs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and you said, too, there was like stones that were worth upwards of like a crore. Like,
no, I'm saying that those kind of stones were available on the website.
But you think the consumer is thinking, oh, great, let me just buy this and send it.
Like, but typically that 1 crore stone, nobody just comes and pays it on the credit card and buys it. But yeah, we have had transactions for as high as 20, 30 lakhs, which where people have just come and placed the order online. And they've bought higher stones also, just that the transaction has not been like a credit card payment. You know, when you buy a 2 crore stone, you can't just swipe your credit card and pay for it. And then obviously the second problem was that it was an international transaction. So obviously all those other considerations. So we really had to go convince them. The lucky thing for us was that to open this payment gateway, we had given them a fixed deposit as a collateral almost. And luckily the value was higher than this transaction. So we were able to tell them that, see, there is no risk for you in that sense.
Right.
So they they gave us like a 2-hour window, I think, where you could get them to place the transaction. So I sent him an email, I confirmed. Then I was like on guard duty at night to make sure that nothing goes wrong. I had my tech person on duty. Obviously, I couldn't ask the bank, but I had checked with them like at closing hours at least that, okay, everything is done, right, to confirm. You know, because this is not a big deal for them, right? This is like one of the 1,000 things they have to do in a day. Somebody could have just forgotten about it, right? While they had confirmed to us. But it was like a matter of life and death literally for us to get this transaction. So we were following up every part of it. I had also made sure that the stones were available, you know, because what happens that the stones are listed in multiple places. Like it's like a hotel room.
Yeah.
Somebody else could have just bought it. So I didn't want that risk. So thanks to, again, Mithun's family, jewelry connections, we had spoken to that vendor, made sure that that stone is blocked for us. Luckily, everything went well at night and we got that order. And, you know, because of, there is so much which, you know, typically today you get thousands of orders in a day, right? You don't care about any order. You don't know so much detail. But when you're at zero and you're hoping for the first order and there is so much drama which happens, you will obviously always remember it.
Everything worked out with this guy. He got his earrings.
And actually, when we completed 10 years, I sent him a message again to thank him that, you know, obviously he wouldn't have thought of it as such a big deal. But it was a big deal for us.
Wow. So this doesn't sound scalable at all, right?
Absolutely not. But you know, the way it has to be done is that, you know, the ecosystem has to also scale, right? And I'll give you an example of that. That, you know, when you're working with Blue Dart, if you're giving them 10 orders in a month, they will not put any resources behind it, right? They will not improve the system. When you're going to a vendor, right, whose feed you have taken and you buy one stone from them every month, they are not going to create anything to make the business better, to make it scalable. So everything, the scale of the business was connected to the scale in a way, right? We also kind of did some other things to bring in that scale. So one of the things which we did, which is another story which I have half written actually, is that we ran a B2B business for the longest time. And the reason to do that B2B business was to solve for scale. Because like I said, a vendor would not give you the time of his day. If you said, I want to buy one stone every month, you had to reach a level of at least 10 a month so that, you know, then he gave you better pricing. And that better pricing is what you could have passed on to consumers, right? Or he gave you better information about the stones, you know, better images and more details so that you also could create better information to enable more buying. And also to get more cash flow, right? Because it was easier to get a B2B business going because you were selling to a jeweler who was anyways buying,
Right? Oh, okay. So you're acting as a middleman between the people who have the stones.
Vendors, yeah, and the jewelers.
And the jewelers.
And a lot of small jewelers who, you know, there were some B2B exchanges which were available at then, but they were paid. So many of the small guys could not even afford the membership for that. And like I said, right, you have to build a relationship with that vendor, which will only get made if you buy regularly. So a small jeweler, you know, in a small town or even a tier two town in India would not have enough business to build a relationship and to have all of that infrastructure in place. So there was an opportunity, which we kind of, although it was also very hard because, you know, there's a lot of the generally the industry is very opaque and the definition of quality also is not very standard. So I told you about the GIA certification. There is an IGI certification, which is an Indian thing, which is of a lower specification. So obviously, if you technically you are still buying the same quality, like a G color, but a GIA G is different from an IGI G, but the customer doesn't care. They want a bigger size. And in fact, people would buy a uncertified stone also. But the way it is done is that you will have to call for that stone. That person will inspect it physically. That was not scalable. And which is why part of our that B2B business also didn't explode so much. It was a good business which helped us build very good relationship with a lot of our vendors. It was a good business that gave us cash flow. And it also taught us a lot about this way to sell solitaires, right? Because we were still helping others sell solitaires. And the best part is that it was how the first relationship with Titan and Tanishq got created, because we were doing this for them also.
Oh, okay. So they were part of that B2B business.
Yes.
Ah.
So they already had a solitaire business. We had created a system where, we powered their backend in a way. We were hoping that we would get more people to sign up for that. That never happened. But there was at least, I would say, reasonable traction for a 3-4 year actually longer. The B2B business continued, although after a while we stopped focusing on it to scale it. We continued the Tanishq relationship, a few other things, but we stopped looking at it as a business which you have to build. It had served its purpose. The relationship with the vendors was established. We had a good relationship going with Tanishq, although at that time we had not invested. And we also, I think in Mithun's mind, he always saw that there was a possibility for a strategic investment or partnership with them, which is why I think, because initially I used to wonder that why is this important? They are, very different from us. But I think in his mind, he had seen that possibility.
Okay, so I just want to take a quick break from this podcast to tell you about this video sponsor, OctaFX, one of India's leading Forex trading brokers. So trading has become a pretty common thing in India over the last couple of years, but there are right and wrong ways to do it. And that's why OctaFX offers webinars as well as tutorials on how to trade well. For example, here's an article on how to adopt a trading strategy in 10 minutes to achieve your trading goals. You've got day trading, scalping, news trading, long-term trading, algorithmic trading, and I could go on and on here, but these kinds of educational resources make OctaFX easy to learn. And once you feel comfortable with the basics, you can even open a demo account to practice trading in a safe, risk-free way. OctaFX also offers more time to trade in comparison to, say, for example, a stockbroking platform, because their app can actually be used 24/7. On top of that, OctaFX offers fast deposits with cryptocurrencies, and overall, it's a really user-friendly platform. The recommended starting deposit on OctaFX is 3,000 rupees, and you can check OctaFX out by clicking on the link in the description down below. Their app is available on both iOS and Android. And also, if you use promo code Backstage100, you can double your first deposit. And that Backstage100 code you can also find in the description. All right, now let's get back to the podcast.
So you guys, today we have this term, right? D2C. That's a really popular term. Everybody's focusing on it. Back then, obviously, it didn't exist. Nobody was talking about D2C. But I think one key component of a successful D2C brand is the brand itself and the image that it's presenting to the public, to consumers, how they feel about the brand. Was that something that you guys were focusing on at that point? Or is
on
it something?
The brand.
Yeah. Had you defined what Carrot Lane was in terms of the consumer facing branding side?
What a brand is also, I think everybody sees it differently. So like we feel that in our case, it's not that we don't have a strong brand. Without investing in brand from a communication campaign point of view, we were able to still build a brand. And it's not that we only feel like that. Our customers also say that. You know, people who are market watchers or industry observers also say that, that we built a very strong brand based on the design which people experienced. And we built a very strong brand based on the customer experience. So today, if you go and ask 100 customers of CaratLane what they love about CaratLane, I think the top 70 would say design. And the next 20 at least would say the customer experience. So those two things helped create the CaratLane brand. But I think the communication part, right, where you start to develop a brand philosophy and you articulate it and you start creating campaigns, so you start creating more awareness and consciousness of that. That came much later. And that, I think today, the somewhere I would say that, you know, the sequence is flipped. People feel that let's do this part first and then the business and the experience would possibly come later. I think it also, one is obviously the number of options which are available today. Obviously, when you have so much more money, I think it also sometimes people possibly feel that that's easier to do than doing the hard work of building a business.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
It will take longer, right?
Yeah.
You feel that you can build a brand by running 3 big campaigns in a month.
Yeah.
But, you know, building the business, is there's no way you can build it in a year.
Yeah. And this, again, was before the big e-commerce boom. So, 08 to 2011, it would have been, were you guys out there trying to raise funds or was that?
No.
You guys didn't?
We had some conversations. But, you know, it was, so we obviously thought that there might be a need for money. And actually, I would, even at that point in time, most of those conversations, Mithun only was doing. It was not even, so I possibly one or two meetings. Actually, the Tiger, and again, I forget his name all the time. He reached out to Mithun out of like nowhere. And then they set up a meeting, they spoke. He had started to invest and understand the e-commerce play or the digital play in India. So he reached out, and Mithun also was, you know, not the seasoned investor he is today. So he also figured out a little bit, got some advice from some people. And then they wrote a check, and that was the first investment which happened.
Oh, was that the Series A?
Yeah, you can call it the Series A.
Okay. In 2011 itself.
Yes.
But by that point, I think you had already stepped away from the company, right?
Yes. In 2011 of January, I'd stepped out.
Yeah. So that's what I saw on sort of LinkedIn, looking at the numbers.
Yeah, 2011, I moved out. 2015, I came back.
Yeah.
Again.
It was like that would, in that period, CaratLane raised Series A, B, C, D. And then you kind of came back after the last funding round had been raised.
So I was actually not involved in any of the Tiger fundings. I was there when the Tanishq thing happened.
The acquisition.
Yes.
Yeah. You obviously had a reason for walking away.
Yeah.
Was it basically just the call of adventure that you wanted to go in?
No. Actually, it was actually the exact opposite of that. So, you know, I'm actually from Ranchi. Most of my parents' family, larger family, etc., is close to that part of the country, right? In Delhi and the nearby areas. We had our first child in 2009. So by 2010, I had been in Chennai for almost 7 years. And at least at that point in time, a lot of people from this part of the country would not want to go to Chennai. Bangalore, definitely, but not Chennai. I didn't have that problem, but I had thought, okay, now I've spent a good enough time in Chennai. So I think it's time to, because, you know, it was not so convenient even via air travel. There was no direct flight to go visit either my parents or my wife's parents. Same difficulty for them also. So that used to be an inconvenience. And you always thought that let's, you know, settling down should happen closer to where you have most of your family, where it's easy to, you know, meet people more often. That was one reason. The second thing was that, you know, because we had a child, so we thought, okay, now we have to raise her. So, you know, all of us want our children to learn about our family and, you know, you want them to speak the language, know the customs and traditions and so on. So we thought you can't teach that, right? You have to, it happens organically when you're around family and you attend those things. So we thought that, okay, then Delhi is a good idea to do that. And at the same time, you know, like I had said, that at that time, I could not imagine what this company would become, right? I had mentioned the optionality which I wanted. So I thought that this has been great, but I don't know what this will eventually become. So nobody was thinking that, you know, it will have this great valuation or it will become such a big business or there will be an IPO or any of those things. You just thought, okay, I had 3.5 wonderful years learning so much and, you know, learning everything by doing. So whether it was marketing or product management or sales or any such thing, you just learned it by doing. So I thought, okay, I had got very good experience. This should open up more opportunities for me to keep doing things like this. But, you know, it was not that I wanted to be in a startup only. I wanted to be, you know, to have an opportunity which was interesting and preferably in one of these spaces, internet or retail, which I had now kind of gotten experience and I hoped ki now I should have more opportunities in this.
Yeah.
So I think I would have much changed person when I came back to Carrotlane as compared to what I was when I had first left.
Yeah. And I heard that it was kind of an accident that you came back in the first place, right? You were asking for a reference.
Yes.
Rather than actually.
I was actually talking to somebody which was also a startup. And that person obviously wanted a reference. And so I called Mithun because I thought better to talk about why I might be a good fit for a startup. So he said, okay, I'll do it. And then he said, why don't you come back? I said, Mithun, I can't go back to Chennai. So in fact, I said, then I said, okay, why don't we, is there a possibility for Bangalore at least? Because Bangalore was better connected and I thought, okay, as a city, at least as compared to Chennai, we thought it might be better. Then he says, Bombay. Bombay actually is a city I had never wanted to go to because I always thought it was only, it was so expensive that only if you were an investment banker, you should go to Bombay. And there's so much travel and tiny houses. So, but at that point in time, you had also realized that, you know, the outside world was slightly different from how it had been in Carrotlane. So from a culture, you know, and working with the Mithun directly and with everybody else, it had been unreally good, right? Because any organization you go to, you learn and you experience some of the bad stuff, right? From a people, culture and stuff. So that much, and that was something which I think I really craved and missed more than anything else.
The culture.
Yeah. It was not like, you know, that Carrotlane had reached a level that I thought, okay, this is great from a financial reward or compensation or role point of view. It was more the fact that, you know, just working there was so much fun and so enjoyable and like working directly with all of these people. And because you still had a chance to build things, it was still not at a stage where you thought, right, it was ready to explode or anything. Because we were still finding our way, we were still making a lot of mistakes, a lot of things still had to be developed. But I think it was the chance to work in that situation which appealed to me, you know, and you felt ki, you know, that was where you could be yourself. Because in a large organization, you are always on your guard.
Yeah.
Who is your friend? Who should you be careful of? Who should, in this place, you could just be yourself and just focus on work and not waste any of your energy or time on other non-productive actions.
Mm-hmm.
I was 35 when I came back to Carrotlane. At the age of 35, you go and join an organization which is still not successful. Raising money is not success, right? It had not reached a level where you could say it was successful. And you have no clarity on the role. But, you know, you just imagine that how many people can make a choice like that.
Yeah.
And the only reason I made that choice because, you know, of that being such a nice place for me and the trust which you had with people. And so you're willing to take that. Today, nobody would join an organization, right? Where they will tell you what your role will be.
Yeah. Did you already have your second daughter at that point?
Yes.
Okay. So that's a
Yeah. So imagine two kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you go to a new city with no clarity on the role. But that was the, you know, the pull of the organization, the pull of getting a chance to work with Mithun again.
Yeah. So you jump back in, I think this was
2015.
And then 2016, this acquisition happens, right? I think it was 62% purchased by Titan.
Yes.
For 350 something crore rupees.
Approximately.
Massive amount of money. How did that change the business and how did that change your outlook on the company?
So obviously the Tanishq thing was very exciting for us because we knew that they would bring in a certain know-how of this business, which was the whole point of wanting them as strategic investors. So we were in a way very excited about that. And we know that that association would do wonders for a business model or in a category where trust was such an important thing. As far as the outlook of the business is concerned, obviously, you know, when you have an investor like a VC, they are seeking something else, right? They are always seeking growth. So they are willing to put in money. They ask different questions. And then when you have somebody like Titan come in, they also want growth, but not at any cost. And because, you know, as an operator, you understand more about the business because they were running a much bigger business, which was at least similar that they had, you know, it was the same kind of customer and it was jewelry. So they obviously would ask you more questions, which say a VC would not ask you. So that changed. And then it was at that time that we started to get our store model right and start to open more stores. And we went through an org restructuring when some of my responsibilities also changed. You know, I got the full online responsibility end to end. It was marketing and product management and sales and customer experience and this analytics, whatever parts. So that ways, and you know, obviously there were now different expectations. So we also knew that we had to now, you know, push for more things. And in that 1 year period, we had noticed enough things which we were not doing well. So we also knew that there were so many opportunities which were there and so much work to be done. So there was at least a path which was very, very visible that if we solve for these problems, if we fix these things, and now we obviously have the support of Titan also in place. So, you know, it was a very, you know, sometimes you are stuck, right? When you don't know what to do. It might be, and sometimes you have this very good situation that, you know, okay, these 15 things, if we do, we can really become a big profitable business. We just have to figure out a way to do it. And now we have understood some of the problems better and we have somebody where there's a lot of know-how who will also help you solve some of those problems. So it, in that sense, it was a very, you know, you get excited by that prospect. So I think that was, and you know, obviously when at a personal level, because your responsibilities change, so you also see that, okay, I can make these things change in many ways. Plus, I think, you know, we had a very, I would say, a broken structure because it was very function driven. You know, a lot of silos in the organization. I remember we used to have these conversations that the marketing team has increased the traffic, but the product and sales teams have not managed to keep the conversion high. And sitting in some of those meetings also, I used to wonder, this is a very wrong way to look at it. There needs to be a way that they have to work together to make it happen. So, you know, when the structure also changed, and so then it gave me a chance to make sure that some of these parts of the organization and these people in these teams were realigned so that they worked on this together and didn't make these kind of statements, right? In a way, it's like a completely different kind of a problem, right? It's as much as a problem of changing the business and doing things better as to change the way people think and work together.
Yeah. So this is like around, the acquisition happened in 2016, which is also a really interesting time because in the e-commerce world, stuff was going on.
Yeah. Right?
I think it was probably 2013 to 2015. There was this huge, like it was massive, basically a bubble, right? It was like so much money was being poured into that space. And Carrot Lane was also in that category of e-commerce, right? Whereas then around 2016, there was a bit of a crash, right? I mean, you saw like Snapdeal had overspent and they kind of went out of business. And then there was Flipkart and Amazon were the only players in that space. What was the situation like for Carrot Lane at that time? Did that affect you guys at all, or being in the jewelry category, was it a little bit different?
See, because we were not in the market to keep raising money, and before and after Tanishq also, we were not kind of trying to chase growth at any cost. So in a way, we were a little disconnected from that, all that action. you know, you didn't worry that I have only so much of a runway and what will I do, etc. In fact, getting Tanishq also made it clear that, you know, they were also in it for the long term. They would not, you know, tell you that, okay, now what do we do? You guys are out of money. And that kind of, that situation happened during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because suddenly, you know, all your plans, we had hoped to become profitable that year, but you suddenly realized that it was not going to happen so soon. So there was another round of money the last time we took money at that point in time. The other reason we were not affected, you know, because we were not in that, because of the funding thing, one is we were not affected so much. But in one way, we were affected because, you know, the people you hire, right? Those people are also looking at all of these opportunities, right? So we used to lose a lot of people to Flipkart. So every year, I think these companies would look at jewelry as an interesting opportunity. And obviously, when you want to build teams to grow that category, you would say, let's get some people from CaratLane, for example. So in that sense, you would be affected because, you know, people who were joining and leaving you were looking at those options, right? So there was a connect. And I think at a customer level also, there would be a connect because finally it's share of wallet, right? If they are buying a lot of clothes on Flipkart or Myntra, somewhere that means there's less money available for us. So but it's not that there was a dramatic change. We would see, you know, like when they would do their big sales, etc., there would be a small impact on business. But I think we were disconnected in general because they were also not big players in our category. In fact, they would try many times because of the high ASP number, the high OVO, but they never made any serious inroads. In fact, we used to first sell on them for a while, but we stopped doing it because it was not even like worth, you know, if you thought of the time which a meeting would take with them, the revenue which we would get on their site was not even giving us a return on that meeting time. It was so bad.
Wow.
It was so low.
Most of the time, I feel like when people buy jewelry, they actually don't want something cheap because that implies it's low quality.
It's not cheap.
Like an 800 rupees ring, right?
That is technically not possible. But I'm saying if you thought of it, you know, even if somebody was buying something for 6,000 rupees, which if you look at it from a traditional lens, that's very, very low price.
Yeah.
But there is decent looking jewelry which we make for 6,000 rupees even today. But actually, their whole ecosystem was not set up for it.
Hmm.
You know, you can't expect people to do a click buy and buy a jewelry product. And their model is also, you know, built in a different way, right? The way their algorithms surface products, they will sell you so much advertising. So it is a good place to buy commoditized products. So like if you are just going to buy gold chains, you will see a lot of options. But it needs a change in their basic model, which they were not willing to, I think, invest in and make a change.
Oh yeah. No, you're never gonna see this omni-channel approach that you guys adopted, right? You're not gonna see an Amazon jewelry store, a Flipkart jewelry store. How far along in that journey were you building this offline approach? How many stores did you guys have at around the time of the pandemic?
Before the pandemic, we had like almost split the organization down the middle.
Wow.
So there was an online team and there was a retail team. So, you know, there was a separate marketing team for online, a separate marketing team for retail. There was a separate sales team, obviously. There was a separate merchandise team. And everybody would operate in their own way. We would have separate P&Ls for online and retail. And while there would still be a lot of people who would discover online and go and buy in stores, but there was not a full organizational alignment and the full organization muscle behind making that happen at scale and in the best possible manner. It was a very broken experience. In fact, you know, for simple things as, you know, when you were making the promotional calendar, there also these teams would sometimes fight and argue that no, for retail this is better or for online this is better. And they would also fight for customers. They would not encourage because they knew that I would not get this credit. So we had started to make some changes in that direction. And one big change we made was when we made all our inventory dynamic. And that was a very difficult thing to do. And it took a lot of conversations. And I think we finally showed some courage to go ahead with it.
Basically making each item in the inventory available
for anybody to buy
online, offline.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was one, I think this real one very big starting point. Then second, we started to change our incentive structures so that people would get credit if the person, you know, spoke to an online salesperson and then went and bought in a store. But some of the other pieces were still broken. In COVID, you know, in a way, and this is one part which people will not realize. People think that COVID, obviously, one big change happened that customers became comfortable buying online and making payments online and browsing. All of that happened and there is no doubt about it. And it helped our business in a big way. But the change which happened in CaratLane was inside was actually bigger.
Oh.
Because we said, boss, now we don't have the... Because we knew that this model of people working in their own silos was also a wasteful, non-collaborative and ineffective method. So we said, now we don't have a choice. We have to kind of combine and work as a unified entity. So we started by, you know, the biggest cost was in marketing. So just one fine day, we decided now there is no online marketing and retail marketing. There is one common demand generation team, which has to work towards making sure that the entire revenue targets and enough demand gets created for it. So the way you started to measure demand for stores and for try at home and online, the way you were looking at journeys, the way you were looking at cost of marketing, everything just changed overnight. You know, teams, their KRAs, their goals, that was one big change. And then accordingly, the merchandising and the sales structures and incentives, all of those things started to change. That, I think, played a very big role because, you know, then it became very collaborative. You started to find many opportunities of improving the experience or conversion. You suddenly, all your metrics started to get really good. There was obviously a COVID impact, but parallelly, there was this unification impact also. That, I think, the two together was a like a force multiplier for us.
Oh, yeah. And then after the pandemic, it seems like just, everything was just...
Yeah, because, you know... See, the thing is that people sometimes forget the early part of a hockey stick. You feel as if that you were not working as hard at that point in time. But a lot of things which we did then, right? The dynamic part, the changes on the website to integrate the journey as an omni journey, the changes in our CRMs, a lot of change on the way we do marketing and sales and training. A lot of our measurement, all of these analytics pieces, a lot of this was happening in the years when we would not even meet our targets. And which is why I remind people that, you know, we were not working less hard or, you know, we were not working with less passion or with less intelligence back then. So when the going is great, don't assume ki now we are, you know, doing a better job. We were doing an equally good job back then. It is that over the years, you know, as scale started to happen and these pieces became stronger and things slowly started to come together. Then there was a COVID impact. Then this unification thing happened. There are other external changes happened, right? Sometimes just the scale also leads to an explosion, right? When you get to a certain number of customers, I think at a 3-4 lakh number of customers, those things also start to happen because there's enough virality, enough word of mouth starts to happen. Parallelly, there was so much work happening on the design side. So I think all of these things started to just, you know, complement each other to create a big multiplier effect. So the big explosive growth and then obviously leading to efficiencies, leading to profitability started to happen. But we should not make the mistake of assuming that, you know, it was only after these big numbers started to happen that really good work was happening. So it was happening earlier also. And I think now we are benefiting from that, and which is why we are also very, very conscious of never dropping our guard, never becoming complacent. Because I'm sure there are other people who are working very hard to be better than what we are doing. And we have also now realized that we are not just competing with jewelry, right? Because of the very high share of gifting and, you know, the price points in which we operate in, even for self-buying, that you are easily replaceable with other categories as well. And so that is one thing we remind ourselves each and every day, not to become complacent and to keep finding new things, you know, new growth drivers, small and big ones, And that's why I say it's still a startup, right? Because there are so many 0-to-1 actions happening all the time. And, you know, our whole Omni thing also has evolved so much from that time, right? This we used to always have this question that when a store opens in a pin code, what is the incremental business? So some of these things were happening much before pandemic, and there were people trying to understand that. And once we started to understand that behavior, then we created a model for store opening, which is, I think, one of the big things which has worked well in our favor, that now we have a very good sense of where there is demand and where we should open stores. So then the whole marketing inventory focus is on very, very sharply defined pin codes where you get much, you know, you don't spread yourself unnecessarily. And similarly, you know, these are all models, right, of how to make better decisions at scale. In various parts of the business there and over the years, pre-pandemic, during pandemic and later, I think the decision-making and the modeling has become much better. You know, it's like a continuous journey, right? So we have kept working at it and it's now reached very, very, I think, advanced levels where the benefit is clearly visible. And I think that's like a never-ending thing, right?
That was Avnish Anand, co-founder and COO of Carrot Lane. And by the way, back in 2007, when Avnish was applying to work at the company, they were actually considering a number of other candidates to join their core founding team, but none of those people ended up joining the startup.
Not knowing how hard it would be helped, because they were also looking at other people to join as part of the core team, but many of them didn't join because they possibly were better informed about the challenges.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to the podcast this week, and I'll catch you in the next one.